Goldfish are a very ordinary fish. They are very common fish. You can buy them about anywhere. They don't cost very much. And as far as I can tell, they're very ordinary looking fish. I don't know if there's such a thing as a cute goldfish or an ugly goldfish. I think they're all pretty much ordinary looking goldfish. And there's nothing real interesting that distinguishes goldfish from other types of fish. They don't have huge dorsal fins like sharks. They don't have long pointy noses like swordfish. They don't have whiskers like catfish. They're ordinary looking. And as far as I can tell, they live ordinary lives. They don't swim upstream like salmon. They swim around and around and around and around the fishbowl. Until you feed them too much one day, then they float in the fishbowl. And then you take them out for their final spin, and they go around and around and around and around the toilet bowl. And so their lives consist of going from the fishbowl to the toilet bowl. You can't get much more ordinary than that. I heard a young man about a year ago at Harding Academy, where I teach, tell of a time that he was at a park. He was walking through this park, and the park had this beautiful stream running through it. He stopped and looked in the stream to find these beautiful fish in the stream. They were over a foot long. He had never seen any so beautiful before. It so happened that a lady was walking by that stream and passed him, and he asked her, he said, "What kind of fish are these? I've never seen any so beautiful before." And she said, "Well, these are goldfish." And he said, "Well, how did they get to be so large?" And she said, "Well, they had a bigger stream to swim in." The man told that like it was the truth, and I didn't believe him. I was thinking to myself, surely there are some genetics involved in this. I don't move into a bigger house and grow a few inches. That just is not how it works. And so I did some research on that. You can go to goldfishguy.com and investigate. Click under housing your goldfish. And the goldfish guy recommends 10 gallons of tank space per goldfish. And he admits that this may sound like an excessive amount of water if you're talking about starting out with small one-inch goldfish, but he says that those small one-inch goldfish have the potential to reach a length of 12 inches or more. So it is, in fact, the truth. Now, you're probably thinking, who cares? But now, we're not interested in goldfish, but what I believe, and the reason I brought this up, is because I believe many times we see ourselves as the goldfish in the fishbowl. We're ordinary. We don't have any talents that someone else doesn't have. There's nothing we can do that someone else can't do and probably do better. And many of us, because of that, are content to live ordinary lives. But I'm convinced as I study God's Word that God sees us as the goldfish in the stream. He sees our potential. He sees what we can become. And the question that God asks Moses from the bush in Exodus chapter 4 and verse 2, "What is that in your hand?" is a question that reminds me of my potential. It reminds me that God sees those things in me that perhaps I can't even see in myself. It reminds me that God sees those things that I can do with His help. God sees us as instruments in His hand. God sees what we can become if we allow Him to use us and mold us in our everyday lives. The purpose of our words today is to inspire us to become instruments of God. And here is the point, as concise as I can make it. God uses ordinary things to accomplish extraordinary things. God uses the ordinary to accomplish the extraordinary. And in order for us to appreciate the life-altering impact of this question that God asked Moses from the bush, in order for us to appreciate the impact that it had in Moses' life, I want us quickly to glance at Moses before the bush, quickly glance at Moses after the bush, and spend most of our time looking at and drawing application from Moses at the bush, especially this question that God asked Moses there and the events surrounding this question in the first part of Exodus chapter 4. If you don't have your Bibles open to Exodus 4, I would encourage you to turn there, Exodus chapter 4, where we'll spend most of our time. And while you're doing that, let me again thank this congregation for the opportunity to be here. It has been a great blessing to me this weekend to enjoy these lectures, to see my family, to meet and reunite with many brothers and sisters in Christ. And I do want to thank the Walkers and many from this congregation for the hospitality, the generosity, and the kindness that you have extended to me while I've been here. To avoid uprooting the bush from its setting, I think it's very important for us to consider the surroundings of the bush. Before we bring the bush and this experience into the foreground of our attention, I think that we should reflect on the biographical background in Moses' life so that we don't isolate this from its context. So to help keep the bush in its place, I want us to notice events in Moses' life quickly leading up to and following the bush experience, because I'm convinced, as is the case with many contexts in the Bible, the better that we understand the surroundings of the bush, the better we will understand the significance of the bush for our situation today and in Moses' life, even then. The manuscript in the book contains a much more extensive biography of Moses' life than what we will deal with at this time, but we're going to mention things that will help set the stage for the question that God asked Moses. Basically, Moses' life can be divided up into three 40-year eras, geographically speaking. His first 40 years were spent in Egypt. His next 40 years were spent in Midian. And his last 40 years were primarily spent in the wilderness. And the first two of these eras, Egypt and Midian, or Moses in Egypt and Moses in Midian, were the two eras that occur before the bush. The last 40-year era in the wilderness was spent after the bush. So let's real quickly get a handle of Moses' experiences before the bush leading up to this experience on God's mountain several years later. I want to highlight four experiences before the bush very quickly. First of all, we see the slaughter. You might be familiar that with Joseph's life. At the end of Genesis, Joseph is in Egypt. His family moves there to be saved providentially by God. They are provided for by Pharaoh, and they are privileged citizens in Egypt, saved from the famine in Israel. But with the turning of the page from Genesis to Exodus comes the turning of the tide for the Israelites. They go from being privileged to being property. They go from being saved to being slaves. They go from being blessed to being bound. Their lives had been made better, and they were now being made bitter by Pharaoh with the hard bondage. And despite this situation, the Israelites prosper. Their growth is stimulated by this. And Pharaoh sees no other option than to get rid of them. And he initiates what we might call a slaughter the sons campaign. He tells the Hebrew midwives to kill the baby boys when they're born. They create this tale that the Hebrew women have their babies before we can get there. And so Pharaoh goes to plan two, what we might call submerge the sons, and says once they are born, you need to put them in the Nile River and have them drown to death. It's in these chaotic times that Moses is born. This leads to the second experience of Moses before the bush, what we might call the salvation. You know, his mother Jochebed hides him in the Nile in an ark. And the irony in this salvation story is hard to miss. For starters, Moses is saved by Pharaoh's daughter. The daughter of the man that is seeking his life actually saves his life. And as if that weren't enough, Jochebed, Moses' mother, is allowed to nurse her boy. And you may recall that the Egyptian, Pharaoh's daughter, the Egyptian that saves Moses, calls him Moses because that name means drawn out. And she found him in the water, she drew him out of the water, and therefore names him Moses. And we don't know much about Moses' early years in the household of Pharaoh, but Stephen does tell us in Acts 7, verse 22, that he was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, so certainly he was made available to the privileges of royalty in Egypt. The next big experience for Moses, though, comes about 40 years later. What we might call the struggle. And this is found in Exodus chapter 2. And this man Moses, who was redeemed 40 years earlier from murder, tries to redeem by murder. And what he does is he tries to take the Israelites' salvation into his own hands before God is ready to act. And I think this struggle with the Egyptian is the outgrowth of a personal inward struggle. He's dealing with his identity. He's trying to come to grips with who he is. And he eventually does come to grips with his Israelite identity. This leads, I believe, to him coming to grips with the Egyptian and killing him. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 25 says that Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, and he chose to suffer affliction with the people of God rather than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Now, what's interesting is that even though he identifies himself with the Israelites, the Israelites do not identify themselves with Moses. And to make matters worse, Pharaoh seeks his life. And so Moses knows that he must evacuate the premises and fast. And this leads to him finding the safety, the fourth big experience in his early years, the safety in Midian. When Moses gets to Midian, he settles down. He marries the daughter of the priest of Midian, Jethro. He starts a family. He becomes a shepherd. And I'm convinced that it's in these years, these 40 years in Midian, that Moses' character is being refined, it's being molded, and it's being set there in the quiet of quaint Midian. And 40 years later, I believe a new Moses emerges from the pastures of Midian. God, like a sculptor, meticulously transforms his block of marble into a masterpiece. And in these 40 years in Midian, God is transforming Moses' character into a masterpiece. I'd like to read a short excerpt from the manuscript. It says, through circumstances in Moses' life, God chisels away Moses' selfishness and reveals his selflessness. Moses' pride crumbles to the floor, exposing his humility. His rugged, unbridled strength is smoothed into meekness. His reckless passion is broken, and his controlled zeal is divulged. His intolerance is smashed into patience. His dependence on self is gradually shaped into his dependence on God. After a few gentle taps, a rash rebel is fashioned into a rational redeemer. God starts with an ordinary block of marble and 40 years later unveils an extraordinary man of God. That is Moses before the bush, the slaughter, the salvation, the struggle, and the safety. Let's quickly notice Moses after the bush. What does he experience in his 40 years after the experience at the bush? First of all, we see the return. He goes back to Egypt, something that I'm convinced that he didn't have any intentions of doing. After all, God did not give him an itinerary on his flight out of Egypt for the next 80 years. Moses didn't know that God had a round trip scheduled for him, but he did. And Moses returns to Egypt, and I'm convinced he returns a new man. The boy that was drawn out of the water returns the man who will draw his people out of Egypt. And you very well remember that he goes back there and he's rejected by Pharaoh. He says, let my people go. Pharaoh says no. And he makes the Israelites' lives harder. He increases their workload and decreases their resources. And so that leads the Israelites to reject Moses. But Moses is more mature now. He is learning to deal with rejection. And he and Aaron go back before Pharaoh. And that is when, at Moses' command, Aaron throws his lifeless staff on the ground, and it turns into a living snake. It consumes the snakes of the magicians, of Pharaoh. But Pharaoh's not impressed. And this sets the stage for one of the most awesome series of miracles the world has ever known, the 10 plagues. This leads us to the second big experience of Moses after the bush, the redemption. The redemption begins with these 10 plagues. The last one is the death of the firstborn. After the death of the firstborn, Moses leads his people out of Egypt. It's then that God uses Moses to part the Red Sea. God uses Moses to turn the bitter waters into sweet waters. God uses Moses to bring water from a rock. The redemption. And this leads us to the third experience of Moses after the bush, which is the revelation. God is now ready to enter into a covenant with his people. Moses scales the mountain to get the conditions of this covenant. And it is there that God reveals these conditions to Moses. It is there that God reveals His nature to Moses, that God reveals His glory to Moses, but He does not reveal His face to Moses. And it's at this time that for short periods of time after these encounters with God, that Moses' face reflects God's glory. The last part of his life is what we might call the rambling, the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And we probably remember what caused this. Numbers chapter 13, 12 spies enter the land of promise to spy out the land. While there, they contract a fatal spiritual disease. A symptom of that disease is what we might call the grasshopper syndrome. They see their enemies as these superhuman people. They see themselves as subhuman. And they say, we cannot take the land. There are giants in the land. We're grasshoppers in their sight. This is a symptom of the disease called doubt. And this disease quickly spreads throughout the camp, save Moses, Joshua, and Caleb. And because of their doubt, God condemns that whole generation to wander aimlessly, to ramble in the wilderness for 40 years. And after these 40 eventful years in Moses' life, Moses, who is Joshua's mentor, who is Israelites' intercessor, and who is God's servant, views the land of promise and dies on Mount Nebo. Moses after the bush. We see the return, we see the redemption, the revelation, and the rambling that leads to his death. Now let's notice Moses at the bush. Exodus chapter 3, the first six verses, here we see the quandary. Moses, I can just imagine the double take when Moses sees this bush that is consumed with the flames but is not consumed by the flames. And then, like two knocks on a door that has been left locked for the last 40 years, God announces His arrival. Moses! Moses! And He instructs him to take his sandals off his feet because the place where he stands is holy ground. Moses does that. And then he learns of his quest in the next few verses. God says, I am aware of the present unenviable situation of the Israelites, and I have come down to do something about it. And I can just imagine Moses applauding this. Yes, it's about time. I can't wait. And then God drops the bomb on this unsuspecting shepherd. He says, I want you to be the person that's going to lead this Exodus out of Egypt. And then that's where Moses immediately begins to dodge the draft. And this leads to the quibble. Moses, because of his deep feelings of inadequacy, presents God with four excuses as to why he is not the man for the job. These four excuses are like four weeds in God's pasture of possibilities. And at the root of each one is this faulty notion that I am too ordinary for God to use. You may recall these excuses. The first one is found in Exodus 3, verse 11. He simply asked, who am I? Now notice, this is not a question of his identity. This is a statement of his inadequacy. He is basically saying, who am I? God, I am not the man for the job. Caleb, he is your man. Joshua, he is your man. Aaron, he is your man. Not me. Look somewhere else. Who am I? What does God say? God says, I will be with you. God reminds Moses, it doesn't matter who he is. It matters who he is. The question is not, who am I? The question is, who is I am? And I am said, I will be with you. The second excuse is found in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 13. Right after God says that, Moses continues with his excuses. And he says, well, God, he says, I don't know what to say to him. You know, they're going to ask who sent me. I won't even know what to say. I don't even know your name. What does God say? For the first time in human history, God reveals His name to a mortal. He says, I am who I am. I am Yahweh, Jehovah. I am the self-existing one. I am. This is the kernel in the shell of this experience at the bush. God reveals his name to Moses, and this is what has intrigued so many people about this passage for so many years, where God actually reveals his name to Moses, something he hadn't done in the centuries prior to this experience. That's his second excuse. The third one is found in chapter 4 and verse 1. Moses says, "They won't believe me. They will not listen to me." He is basically saying, even if I had something important to say, they wouldn't listen. I'm not a leader. I'm a follower, God. And they're not going to pay me any attention. What's interesting about this excuse is that it shoots out of the fertile ground of God's assurance. He has just told Moses in chapter 3 and verse 18, they will listen to you. They will believe you. They will hearken to your voice. But Moses needs proof. And that's what he gets. He gets three lines of evidence that God does want him. These are three things that prove to him and that will prove to the children of Israel that he is the God-appointed deliverer of them. The first thing that happens is his rod becomes a snake. The second thing that happens is his hand turns leprous and then turns back to normal. And the third thing is that he is told that he can make the water turn into blood when he gets to Egypt. But Moses isn't finished yet. He has one more card up his sleeve. He says, "I am not eloquent." Chapter 4 and verse 10. I'm not eloquent. And many people have debated whether or not this is a legitimate physical weakness of Moses or whether this is just a mental inhibition that he has. But regardless, it seems superficial to wonder that at this juncture, because the point is that God will use Moses regardless, and maybe because of any human weaknesses that he has. God is not looking for Moses' ability. God is looking for Moses' availability. It is not God's, it's not Moses' responsibility, but his response to God's ability that will lead his people out of Egypt. And what does God say to this? God says, he responds with the question, "Who has made man's mouth? I will be with your mouth." And he affirms to Moses a truth that we all need to learn, and that is, where God gives a commission, he always gives the resources to fulfill it. These are four excuses that Moses gives to God. But now let's zero in on the third excuse, what we will call the question. In chapter 4 and verse 1, Moses says, they won't believe me. Then God asked Moses in chapter 4 and verse 2, "What is that in your hand?" What is that in your hand? I can just imagine what is going through Moses' mind when God asked him that question. He's probably thinking, "Well, God, I've got a rod in my hand. It's just a stick. I picked it up off the ground about 40 years ago. It's just a dead piece of lumber. I've been hitting animals with it ever since. If a sheep gets out of line, I'll pop it with the rod. If a wild animal comes, I'll smack it with this stick. It's just an ordinary piece of wood." God says, "Well, Moses, throw it on the ground. Put it back where you found it." He does that, and what happens? It turns into a snake. And when God catches up to Moses, he says, "Moses, pick that snake up by its tail." Moses does that. It turns back into a rod. And before Moses knows it, he is standing back in front of the bush holding his anything but ordinary rod. Now, what does this experience and this question say to us? I think this experience, this question, challenged Moses to see. It challenged Moses to see things that he has never seen before. It challenged Moses to see things in a different light. It changed his perspective of at least two things. First of all, it changed his perspective of the rod that he had in his hand. Moses, after this experience, I'm convinced, viewed this rod as an instrument in God's hands. In the 40 years that this rod has been in his hand, it had done absolutely nothing that closely, even remotely, resembled the remarkable. But as soon as he put the rod in God's hands, into God's service, it turns into a snake. In chapter 4 and verse 17, God says, "Moses, take this rod with you because you're going to use this rod to do wonderful things." And Moses takes it with him, and he uses the rod to do extraordinary things. He holds it over the Red Sea, and the Red Sea parts. He uses it to inflict the plagues in Egypt. He strikes the rock with it and water comes out. This rod is now an instrument in God's hands. Now, what's the message for us? Here it is. What God has put in our hands, we should put in His service. In essence, give back to God what He has given to us and allow God to use those things through us that He has blessed us with. For Moses, it was a rod. For Shamgar, it was an ox goad. For David, it was a sling. For Dorcas, it was a needle and thread. For the boy by the sea, it was lunch. For the widow, it was two mites. For Jesus, it was two nails. For Paul, it was a pen. The question for us is, what will it be for us? Think about all the wonderful things, maybe the ordinary things, that God has placed in our hands that we now must put in His service, give back to Him, and allow Him to use those things to do great things, even in our day. Now, here is the big step we've got to make. Not only did Moses change his perspective of the rod, he changed his perspective of himself. Not only did he see the rod as an instrument in God's hands, I believe this experience encouraged him to see himself as an instrument in God's hands. And probably when he saw the rod in his hand, he was reminded of the fact that he was an instrument in the hands of God. I mentioned the grasshopper syndrome a few minutes ago in Numbers chapter 13. I feel that many times when we study the Bible, and we read about these great Bible characters, we, if we're not careful, may be inflicted with the grasshopper syndrome ourselves. What I mean is, we look at these great Bible characters and we say, well, the reason God used them is because they were so great. We see them as these spiritual giants and we see ourselves as grasshoppers in their sight. But I think we need to see two things about Moses and many other Bible characters. Those two things we need to see is this. Number one, they were real. They were real people. In other words, God did not use them because they were great. They were real people. The second thing we need to understand is that God was real in their lives. They were great because God used them. God did not use them because they were great. They were great because God used them. Case in point, Moses. Moses was a man that had a past history of failure. He had tried that whole deliverance thing once before and it didn't work. He was old. He was 80 years old when God appeared to him at the bush. And what's interesting is in Psalm 90, do you remember what that psalm said in verse 10? Man can expect to live about 70 years. If he's really strong, he'll live 80 years. Who wrote that psalm? Moses. I don't know when he wrote that psalm, but I'm convinced that perhaps Moses, when God appeared to him, he thought he was finished. He thought he was through. He thought his work for the Lord was over with. But God used the last third of his life to do more powerful things than he had done in the first two-thirds of his life. From age 80 to 120, Moses was more productive than he had ever been for God. God used Moses in spite of his human weaknesses. Same thing with Gideon. If you look back in Judges chapter 6, Gideon is first seen where? In the wine press. Why is he there? He's scared to death. The Midianites are after them. The Midianites, I don't know if you've seen the movie A Bug's Life, but the grasshoppers come in and destroy all the ants' harvest and all this. Well, that's pretty much the scene in Judges 6. The Midianites will come in and wipe out the Israelites' harvest, take everything they have, and Gideon knows it's coming. He's hiding in the wine press. You thresh wheat in a threshing floor, not in a confined wine press, but that's where Gideon is because he's scared. Judges chapter 6 and verse 11. In verse 12, however, the angel of the Lord says to Gideon, calls Gideon a mighty man of valor. He is scared to death. But the angel calls him a mighty man of valor. God saw Gideon in the stream before he ever got his feet wet. God saw Gideon's potential. Gideon says in verse 13, He says, God, he says, I am from the weakest clan. I am the youngest in my family. He says, where is God? I've heard all these wonderful things that God has done. I haven't seen a thing yet. But the angel says that God will be with you. And the pivotal verse comes in Judges 6 and verse 34. It says, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. Literally clothed himself with Gideon. How did Gideon defeat the Midianites with an army of 300? Because the Lord was with him. The Lord was real in his life. He was real, but the Lord was real in his life. How about David? David is the Cinderella story in the Bible, 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7. There Samuel comes not to see whose foot fits in the glass slipper, but to see whose head fits in the crown. He goes through seven of David's brothers. None of them are chosen. God says, don't look at the outward appearance, look at the heart. Here comes David. Samuel appoints David. God anoints David to be king. A pivotal verse, 1 Samuel 16, 13. Despite the fact that David is young, despite the fact that David is ordinary, despite the fact that no one believes in David, God does. God sees his potential. And it says that the Spirit of the Lord came upon David, verse 13. In verse 14, it says the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. Why? 1 Samuel 15, 17. Samuel asked Saul, when you were small in your own eyes, were you not great? See, Saul got too big for his britches. He got too big for God. And the principle here is you can be too big for God to use, but you can never be too small for God to use. Saul got too big for God to use. So God had to go to David. The same thing with Elijah. Elijah was a discouraged prophet, but God used him despite the fact that he was susceptible to discouragement. At the end of 1 Kings 18, do you know what Elijah does? Elijah outruns Ahab's chariot to Jezreel. There's no one with the stopwatch there, but that was probably the fastest fastest marathon, really. It's 30 miles to Jezreel from where he was, the fastest marathon anyone's ever run. Not because he was a world-class sprinter. You look back in the context, 1 Kings 18, 46, it says the hand of the Lord came upon Elijah. That's how he could outrun Ahab's horses and chariot to Jezreel. Same thing with the apostles. In Acts 1 and verse 1, we see the secret to the apostles' success. The former account I made to you, O Theophilus, of all that Jesus began to do and teach. The book of Luke is not the end of Jesus' work, it's the beginning of Jesus' work. The book of Luke shows Jesus' work in his physical body. The book of Acts shows his work in his spiritual body, the church. And the reason they turned the world upside down for Christ is because Jesus was working through them. A better title for that book is The Acts of Jesus Through the Apostles, because Jesus was empowering them to do those great things. My personal favorite is Paul. We see him called Saul, Acts chapter 7. He's holding the coats of the men that stoned Stephen. In Acts chapter 8, he's making havoc of the church. In Acts chapter 9, he's on his way to Damascus to kill more Christians. In Acts 9 and verse 15, it says that Paul is my chosen instrument to preach to the Gentiles. God used Saul despite his bad, sinful past. Our sinful past may be the black velvet on which the diamond of God's grace is displayed, if we allow God to forgive us and use our lives the way he used Saul of Tarsus' life. Let me leave you at this point here. Before we become God's instruments, we must become his temples. God must work in us before he can work through us. He must indwell us before he can empower us. We must become his temple. Then we will become his instruments. God would not have made us if he can't use us. And God will never leave a vessel fully consecrated to him unused. God will always use a vessel fully consecrated to him. Let me challenge all of us, become his temple. And rest assured, if we do that, he will use us to become his instruments in this world. Thank you so much for your attention.